Donald Trump knew about the dangers of the virus from the start, has called soldiers killed in combat losers, and is closing the gap on Joe Biden in some key states. Surprised? Join the rest of us on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. With 8 weeks to go, the presidential race is narrowing, especially in the battleground states. How are voters judging the candidates?
Many people still feel as though this unconventional presidency is more representative of the way they would like to push back, and they don't see the same sort of expression of themselves in what they're getting from the Democratic Party.
Plus, Minnesota hasn't voted for a Republican since Richard Nixon in 1972. Can Donald Trump end the GOP losing streak?
This is a state that may be tipping the way much of the rest of the Midwest went. Minnesota could be in play in 2020, and it could also flip over to the Republican side and to Donald Trump.
And will Democrats pick up enough seats to win a majority in the Senate? It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 345 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. I watch the upheaval in the streets, the not-so-peaceful demonstrations, outrage and looting, and I hear Donald Trump say, if Joe Biden were president, this is what your country will look like. Of course, this is happening under President Trump's watch. An election that was always supposed to be a referendum on Donald Trump may instead become a warning, courtesy of the White House, of America under Biden. Swing state polls are narrowing, even as the COVID death count mounts. It's going to be a brutal final 2 months. Before we go any further, we have a housekeeping note. We never told you who won our Guess Biden's Running Mate contest from back in March. As it turned out, the first person to predict it would be Kamala Harris was Cheryl Like of Rosemount, Minnesota. Cheryl wins not only a Political Junkie t-shirt and not only a genuine McGovern-Eagleton button from 1972, but an opportunity to appear on The Political Junkie. Cheryl, congratulations on your tremendous victory.
Thank you, Ken. I'm very excited.
Well, tell me what made you think it would be Kamala Harris?
Well, when she dropped out, I just kind of knew that that wasn't it for her. And I knew she'd be at the top of the list for the VP spot. And especially when we knew Biden was going to be the nominee, I thought for sure it would be her. I knew we had to have a woman on the ticket.
Are you a fan of hers? I mean, did you particularly like her as a presidential candidate?
She was in my top three. I really wanted a female to be the candidate. So I did like her. She wasn't my top choice. But.
Now, you live in Minnesota. Was Amy Klobuchar on your list?
She wasn't one of my favorites.
Okay.
I like her in the Senate, though.
I do know, I mean, by all accounts, there's a lot of attention put on Minnesota because the election there is getting very close. Do you want to take a stab who not only is going to win Minnesota in November, but who's going to be the next president of the United States?
Oh, I am absolutely going to say Biden for both. I know they like to think that they're going to get Trump to win here, but I just don't see it happening.
Now that you've appeared on The Political Junkie, what's left for Cheryl Like?
I guess go to Disney World.
Cheryl, thanks so much. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That's Cheryl Like of Rosemount, Minnesota, the winner of The Political Junkie Guess Biden's Running Mate contest. Cheryl, take care.
Thank you.
And all of that leads to this week's trivia question. Kamala Harris, before she was elected to the Senate, was Attorney General for the state of California. Who was the last major party vice presidential nominee who previously had served as AG? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. the winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. The primaries are over. The conventions are over. The only thing we have left in the 8 weeks or so before the election are the debates and nonstop distortion, lies, anger, and ugliness. At a time when politics seems more brutal than ever, the next 2 months are not going to be for the faint of heart. I suspect NPR's Ron Elving shares many of the same sensibilities about politics as I do. We love it. We love the history, the lore, the great stories, the amazing people who believe in government and making the world a better place. But we despair when it comes to the meanness, the bullying, the making up stuff, the appeals to bigotry and hate. And yet, for some reason, we continue doing what we do, whatever it is that we do. Ron Elving, what is it that we do anyway?
I really couldn't have described the whole situation any better than you just did. We do still love it. We love everything about it. We always have. And we are saddened, I think is probably the best word, saddened, by what's happened to the discourse. At the same time, if people like us get out of it, then it's going to be nothing but the people who want to debase the discourse and no more of the people who want it to be about something and to actually matter. So I think we need to hang in there as long as we can.
I suspect your description is absolutely right. You know, some people will say to me, oh my goodness, with all these headlines and everything, you must love what's happening. And I say, oh, no. I love politics, but I don't love what's happening. So I have a feeling you and I are in the same boat. Unfortunately, it's the Titanic.
Yeah, let me hand you another oar. Could you hand me the life jacket?
Please. Anyway, I want to open with what Donald Trump said to the American people back in September of 2015.
We will have so much winning if I get elected that you may get bored with winning. Believe me.
Ron, explain, if you can, in one sentence, what has happened to America in the 5 years since?
There has been some winning from the standpoint of Donald Trump. Not only did he win the presidency, which a lot of people thought was a victory for them, a populist uprising, if you will, and that was meaningful in and of itself for a lot of folks. He also passed some changes to the tax code. I don't think it helped a lot of the people who voted for him, but it did help some of the people who voted for him a lot. And it really transferred most of its wealth value to a very small percentage of taxpayers. And, of course, there was also a change in the relationship with various countries. The president was much more assertive in confronting Iran, and for a while he seemed to be romancing North Korea pretty successfully. But those situations have not really gotten materially better. We're at odds with our allies. And our trade relationships, while they may be more pleasing to the president in the sense that he is punishing people he thought have been, quote, ripping us off for years, unquote, well, it still hasn't really redounded to the benefit of American farmers, and American manufacturing workers are still looking to see the benefit, too. So somebody might be winning, but it isn't necessarily all of the people who voted for Donald Trump.
That's fair to say, but I think it's also fair to say that 7 or 8 months ago, Donald Trump had a good chance of getting reelected. The economy was strong. Unemployment was the lowest in years. And now, you know, with a pandemic claiming 190,000 American lives, infecting nearly 6.5 million people, with millions out of work, businesses being shut down, Donald Trump still has a good chance of getting reelected. And explain that to me.
Because many people still feel as though this unconventional presidency is more representative of the way they would like to push back against Washington, against the elite, against the educated and affluent, And they don't see the same sort of expression of themselves in what they're getting from the Democratic Party, not from Joe Biden, not from Kamala Harris, maybe not even from Bernie Sanders, although many of the people I'm talking about might have found him sort of seductive in his own way. So there are a lot of folks who, while they are obviously disappointed in some aspects of this presidency, and they must feel uneasy with what they're learning about how the president responded to the virus challenge. We now know that he knew much more about how deadly it was, very specific, hard data about how deadly it was. As far back as January and February, while he went on through the whole month of February telling people it was nothing more than a case of the flu, when he knew it was five times deadlier. And we know he knew that because he told Bob Woodward that, the reporter Bob Woodward, on tape, and now we've heard the tape. So, yes, the president knew a great deal more than he was letting on, and that might just make an impression on some of the people who still had faith in him after all that's happened. Some of those people might now be asking, why didn't he do a better job of protecting me and my family from coronavirus 19?
You know, I was just thinking of one of the main reasons, I think it's fair to say, given for Trump's victory in 2016 was Hillary Clinton. I mean, yes, there was James Comey, there were the Russians, there was the vote suppression, certainly, and all that. But there was also Hillary Clinton, who had clearly had her own negatives and faults. I'm sure Joe Biden is determined not to make the same mistakes. I mean, he will campaign in Wisconsin, for example, but how would you assess his campaign, even though it really seems to be just getting started now?
It's hard to assess a campaign that has consisted so much of Zoom appearances, essentially, and various kinds of broadcast connections out of his basement in Delaware. So it's not a traditional-looking campaign. The president's hasn't been quite yet either, although it's getting closer, and he does want to get out and have the live rallies that lifted his career back in 2015 and 2016, really not only made him president, but also kept up this sense that he was the people's man all through those first 3 years. So he wants to be out there doing that and will probably continue to do it, even at the risk of creating super spreader events. And many of these people are not wearing masks or social distancing. The president doesn't seem to be encouraging or requiring them to do so. So that could backfire, as it did indeed in Tulsa when he got back out on the trail earlier this summer, maybe a little prematurely. So we'll see how it works out for him. But that contrast still works in his favor. It's one of the reasons that he still has a fighting chance in this election. He might be down 6 or 7 points nationally, but that's influenced by a handful of super populist states, and doesn't really account for his popularity in some of the swing states. Florida, for example, is 50-50. Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin are certainly not in the bag for Joe Biden by any means. And President Trump thinks he can turn New Hampshire and Minnesota for insurance. So you're right. He does still have a fighting chance of being reelected, despite the virus, despite the recession, and despite the racial unrest in this country, which he essentially disowns and blames on everyone else but himself.
Kamala Harris, you know, we always do this every 4 years. We make such a big deal of the running mate. Do you see any sign that she is making a difference, or I guess that's separate from whether she could make a difference?
That's right. The first rule for vice presidents is do no harm. Don't cost your nominee anything. Then number two, bring something if you can. Usually people have associated that with a state. Well, California, her home state, is not in question. It's not in play. So what she does bring is a fulfillment of his promise to put a woman on the ticket, number one. And number two, an outreach to people of color. And not only African Americans, but also South Asian Americans who have often seemed or felt overlooked in American political talk. Even when we talk about communities of color, we don't often, at least not in the past, we haven't focused on Indian Americans. And so she has a connection there, too. And it's very interesting to think that she could be the first many things in the vice presidency, and in that job have a, well, enviable springboard towards the eventual nomination of the party for the top job.
Whether the Democrats win or not this year, right?
Yes.
It seems like a long time ago, but what did you make of those virtual national conventions? Start with the Democrats.
I thought it was pretty slick. It was much more presentational than I could have expected. The Democrats have been trying for years to catch up to the Republicans in putting on a good show. Sometimes they have managed to do that in their live conventions. But this was really slick. It really looked like 2 hours of primetime television. There were a lot of television personalities, movie personalities. There were a lot of attractive people. And then there were also presentations by actual Democratic politicians. And they were pretty good. They were well produced. They were short. They got to the point. They followed a lot of good telegenic values. And as a result, I think the Democrats made a pretty good impression, and they didn't cost themselves any ground. The Republican convention was a hybrid. It had some of the virtues that I was just describing, and it also had a fair amount of live activity, most of it coming from the Andrew Mellon Auditorium in downtown Washington, just a few blocks from the White House. But also, you saw the president get out there on the south lawn of the White House with a audience of invited Republican members of Congress and cabinet members and so on, get a very enthusiastic response from that group. And while that offends many people to see the president exploiting his home address to make his political acceptance of his political party's nomination, nonetheless, here again, this is another one of those conventions and norms that matters to older people or more traditional people or people who may not like Donald Trump in the first place. It doesn't seem to bother his voters. And we'll see if it disturbs any of the people who are in that shrinking category of persuadable, undecided swing voters.
Could this be the wave of the future? The way the conventions were this year, could that be the wave of the future for conventions?
It could be. It could be. At least I think we'll see hybrid elements of both, because there is a natural excitement to seeing a large group of people get very enthusiastic in a place. It's a little bit the same problem we're having with baseball. I mean, if you love baseball the way you and I do, the way you do especially, you probably don't need a crowd to get into the game. But for many people, it's just not the same thing if there's no crowd, if there aren't a lot of people getting excited about the game. Now, I grew up as a Cubs fan in Chicago, and I'd go out to games, and sometimes the hot dog vendors outnumbered the fans. But I'm used to this, right?
Especially at night.
We didn't even get the... Okay, a little note to listeners. In those days, there were no lights at Wrigley. But, you know, we did have a good time. Anyway, the point being that we don't really know that much about how people reacted to it. The audiences were not huge. There weren't Super Bowl crowds by any means. There were maybe slightly more people watching the Democratic convention on 3 out of 4 nights. The only night the Republicans were in first place was Melania's night, kind of ironic. And yet, it wasn't an overwhelming crowd, and there doesn't seem to have been very much effect on the polls. So, yeah, we need to have these things. I think they serve a purpose, but I think they should be paid for by the parties, and I think they should be done as inexpensively as possible. And if you can get by with something less than 100,000 people descending on Philadelphia or Charlotte, North Carolina, that's probably a good idea.
You know, you mentioned earlier about Trump knowing about the virus before he admitted it, and that came from the new Bob Woodward book. There seems to be no shortage of books tearing apart Trump's life, his life, his lies, his business practices. The book from Mary Trump, Michael Cohen, Peter Strzok has a book, as well as Bob Woodward, and then the quotes about him disparaging soldiers killed in combat as losers. I just wonder what else can possibly be written that we haven't heard before, or that could change anyone's mind about Trump. I mean, the stuff I'm reading in these books is just startling, but it all seems to become numbing at some point.
I believe that it has become numbing. And what's more, I think that people who like Donald Trump have simply formed a kind of defense system against hearing all of this, so that even if they hear it on tape, as they will with the Woodward quotes, they're just going to reject it. They're going to shrug their shoulders. They're going to say it was out of context. They're going to wait to hear what Donald Trump says about it, and whatever he says, they'll say, that sounds right to me. Now, I don't mean to dismiss these people as being, you know, fact-resistant. I'm just saying they think politics as a whole is corrupt, that the people who run for office and do it for a long time, like Joe Biden, are automatically more corrupt than the people who have made their living in the private sector and only entered politics at like this phase of their life, in their eighth decade. That may seem more legitimate to some people. Plus, They just like Donald Trump, and they don't want to see him lose. And they aren't very excited about the prospect of what they see the Democratic Party doing and taking the country toward. And they're worried about what they see with the Black Lives Matter movement and some of the violence in the streets. They are concerned about all of that, and that will probably still dominate their vote. But what I really wonder is, how are they going to feel about the prospect of another 4 years of Donald Trump and all the things that have come with his presidency, including all these revelations about his life? How are people going to feel about signing on for another 4 years of that?
Do you have, any expectations about the upcoming debates?
I'm still wondering whether or not they're going to be entirely without an audience. It's hard for me to imagine the debates without an audience. Now, that, you know, you and I remember the 1960 Nixon-Kennedy debates. There was no appreciable audience.
Well, there was no audience with Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders in the last debate either.
And I think that probably helped Joe Biden,
yeah,
because Bernie Sanders is far more exciting to an audience,
right,
as is
right.
Donald Trump.
Right.
So if you could have had those debates that we saw between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in 2016 with no audience, my suspicion is that Hillary Clinton would have done even better. I think she did fine, but I think she would have done even better without that sort of sense that the audience was hanging on every word and every step that Donald Trump made. So I really think it's going to be different and interesting and perhaps more like the old debates that we saw in another era of presidential politics before we got into this habit of insisting that there be an audience and allowing the audience to respond.
I've noticed that polls in several key battleground states have narrowed in recent days. You know, states that once had Biden up have tightened considerably. What do you think is causing that?
Some of that, I think, is reaction to the unrest, to the sense that somehow things are coming unglued in some of the cities.
This wouldn't happen if Trump were president.
Well, exactly. How does a president run against the status quo? How does he run against the times during which he is president? Well, you know, frankly, you do it by putting it on forces that you don't identify with and are very, very willing to criticize. Black Lives Matter, the sort of semi-imaginary Antifa, which is not an organized group, but sort of a concept. You know, things of that nature, that will resound with people who are disquieted by what they see in Kenosha and Portland. And that's not a small number of people. Now, it may not make all the difference in Wisconsin or Oregon, but it does make some difference all over the country where the kind of people we're talking about, folks who have maybe not been to college or maybe not gotten a college degree and who have identified with the Democratic Party traditionally, historically, but felt that that party moved away from them, became more a bunch of academic liberals, and also a party that went from being about one-fifth people of color to being two-fifths people of color, which it is now. It's about 40% people of color, and they may not be as comfortable with that as they were with the Democratic Party of 50 years ago. So those people very possibly are coming home to their vote for Donald Trump. Some of those people might have very different motivations entirely, but that seems to be the main thing that has changed more than any influence from the conventions, more than any kind of sudden mistake or gaffe that Biden may have created on his own.
Do you have any thoughts about how fair the election is going to be? I mean, Trump keeps saying it's going to be rigged. Of course, that means it's going to be rigged against him. But, you know, there are many people who are concerned that mail-in ballots won't get counted. What do you think?
I think the biggest enemy of a clean and fair count in the past has been complacency. People didn't realize in Florida in 2000 that they needed to be careful about making sure they had punched through all the way on their ballot. People didn't realize that there was going to be a huge question about every individual ballot. If people had been aware of that in Florida in 2000, they might have been a little more careful. Now that people know that there are problems when everyone's trying, in some states everyone, trying to vote by mail, let's hope that people will be more conscientious and they will say, I better get this in early and not just try to run it down to the post office on Monday afternoon, November 2nd. That may not work. And so if people are much more conscientious about it, and if all the state officials and local officials who have to do with this are more conscientious about it, and they're planning ahead and they're doing all the things they need to do, then it's conceivable that we could have an election that is not that much in dispute. It doesn't judge which way it might go. It just says it might not really be all that disputable in very many places. And that would probably be satisfactory to most people. But if it's terribly close, and if it's terribly close in enough states to affect the Electoral College, then, well, we're going to be in uncharted territory even more than we were in 2000.
The next 2 months are going to be fun, aren't they?
It's a strange definition of fun, but they certainly will be riveting.
Ron Elving is a senior correspondent at NPR, and always, Ron, having you on the show is a privilege and a pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's a privilege and a pleasure for me, Ken. Thank you very much.
Not to touch the earth, not to see the sun, nothing left to do but run, 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 let's run. Let's run. House upon the hill, moon is lying still, shadows of the trees, witnessing the wild breeze. Come on, baby, run with me. Let's run.
Anyone who was looking at the TV coverage of the 1984 presidential election couldn't help but notice that on the map of the United States, only one state looked different from the rest. It was, as it turned out, the only state to go for Walter Mondale in his battle against President Ronald Reagan. Here's NBC's Tom Brokaw on election night 84.
We can now, I am told that we can, in fact, project Walter Mondale, the winner of the state of Minnesota. That is his home state. That is the single state that he will win tonight. It has 10 electoral votes. It is his home and his headquarters. It is the taproot of his whole political philosophy. Minnesota colored red tonight for Walter Mondale. He can claim his pride in his native state and in his neighbors and the people who sent him to Washington as a senator and elected him attorney general as well. And from that, he can claim some victory. So here's the Electoral College total one more time tonight. 13 for Walter Mondale, 525 for President Reagan.
Minnesota voted for Mondale as a presidential candidate in 1984 and as a vice presidential candidate under Jimmy Carter in 1976 and 1980. And it has stayed with the Democratic Party in 11 straight presidential races. But don't let that statistic fool you. There are major pockets of conservative strength in the state. 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton did outpoll Donald Trump, but just by 44,000 votes out of more than 2.8 million cast, a difference of a point and a half. Now, with a growing backlash to the rioting and looting in Minneapolis following the George Floyd killing, some are saying that Trump could break the streak and carry the state in November. David Schultz is a political science professor at Hamline University in St. Paul and author of the book Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter. Professor Schultz, welcome to The Political Junkie.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for the audience.
Well, it's stunning that we're talking about Minnesota. I mean, everybody always talks about Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, North Carolina, but, and of course, Minnesota may hold the current record of consecutive votes for Democratic presidential candidates, but that hardly makes it the most liberal state or one of the most liberal states in the country, right?
That's correct, because, you know, if we look at states like obviously California, Massachusetts, and New York, they're more solidly liberal overall. And Minnesota has sort of lived on a little bit of a reputation. Now, a little bit of a reputation is, as you pointed out, the last time Minnesota voted for a Republican for president was Richard Nixon in 1972. You think of Minnesota, you think of people like what? Walter Mondale, Hubert Humphrey, Paul Wellstone. The major political figures.
Eugene McCarthy.
Eugene McCarthy from a different era also. So you think of liberal Democrats. But surprisingly, what people don't realize is this is a state that may be tipping the way much of the rest of the Midwest went. And what I mean by that, bracket off Illinois. We saw in the last election, most of the Midwest shift over to Donald Trump. He picks up Michigan, picks up Wisconsin. Depending on whether you consider Pennsylvania Midwest or not, he picks that up. He wins Iowa.
And Ohio.
Ohio, exactly right. So So we've got the Midwest, which used to be noted as what, you know, sort of a strong bastion for the Democrats. It was what, labor country, it was manufacturing, it was agriculture. You know, Minnesota's Democratic Party is called the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, not just Democratic Party, but DFL. And lots of those constituencies nationwide and in Minnesota are moving away from the Democrats to the Republican side. And there are many reasons to think that Minnesota could be in play in 2020, and it could also flip over to the Republican side and to Donald Trump.
Well, before we get to 2020, let's stick with 2016 for just one second. Why was it so close? I mean, I know Hillary Clinton never set foot in the state, and perhaps part of the reason was overconfidence, but why? I mean, President Obama carried Minnesota twice by more pretty sizable numbers. 2016 was close. How come?
Well, okay, just to give you a picture here. In 87 counties in Minnesota. In 2008, Barack Obama won 42 of those 87 counties, roughly half. In 2012, he wins 28 of those counties. In 2016, Hillary Clinton only wins 9 counties. I mean, she wins the urban cores, you know, where Minneapolis and St. Paul are, and a couple of others, and that's it. So what happened? Okay, there's two different theories that I throw out here. One of them you hinted at is that Clinton made some tactical errors along the line, that we had a caucus system back in 2016. Bernie Sanders beats her in the Minnesota DFL caucus almost 2-1, just really destroys her. And she never comes back to campaign in Minnesota after losing in the caucus, perhaps thinking this is a reliable state, takes it for granted, almost loses it. This is the same story that we saw in Wisconsin and Michigan, where Bernie Sanders beats her in the primaries in both of those states. She doesn't come back to campaign. She loses those states. So one, we could just say, okay, tactical error on the part of Clinton. But before even 2016, I had done research and basically said there are all kinds of indications that Minnesota was moving from being a reliably Democratic state to perhaps a swing state and maybe flipping. And if we started to look at, for example, the percentage of the population that identified themselves as Democrat versus Republican, that gap had narrowed. The number of counties that were increasingly solidly Republican as opposed to Democrat had increased. We saw traditional areas of Minnesota called the Iron Range. The Iron Range in northern Minnesota, which used to be, as the name indicates, a mining area, reliably labor, reliably working class, white working class, it was starting to flip and vote increasingly Republican. So we saw lots of signs out there that even without Clinton making some tactical errors, this was a state that showed lots of characteristics of other states in the Midwest that had flipped in previous elections, or other states in the country that seemed to be moving Republican.
We have fewer than 8 weeks to go before the election. What is Minnesota looking like right now?
Well, first off, it's even less than 8 weeks, because in about 10 days, the ballots are going to be mailed out for people who are requesting early voting. So we're actually going to start to see election occurring very rapidly. Now, if we were having this conversation, let us say back in July, Joe Biden looked like he had about some polls were saying a double-digit lead. Most of us were thinking probably a solid single-digit lead. Well, since then, we've had several things occur, which is obviously the death of George Floyd, the demonstrations, and the riots as a result. And there are indications that the race has dramatically tightened in the state of Minnesota to where it may be just a few percentage points at this point, you know, plus or minus. And I think partly it's been a result of what? I think it has been President Trump very adeptly talking about the law and order issues in Minnesota and how that's resonating with greater Minnesota. Similarly, we have a U.S. Senate race. Tina Smith, the incumbent, the Democrat, Jason Lewis, The challenger, Jason Lewis, when he won in a congressional seat a few years ago, won it on the coattails of Donald Trump in 16. That race, Senate race, which was also a double-digit lead for Tina Smith, she has largely seen her lead evaporate. So we're very competitive. Both Trump and Biden have recently made, as of September 1st, major ad buys in the state of Minnesota. So we're looking at right now the state being definitely in play in terms of how the candidates are viewing it. And even if it's really not in play, what's happening is because Minnesota has been such a linchpin to the Democrats' presidential fortunes, I think Trump is forcing the Democrats to defend this state and not letting them take it for granted. And this is important because in the last few weeks, Donald Trump has visited here. Mike Pence has visited here. Donald Trump has had his children come here. Originally, Joe Biden was saying a couple of weeks ago, he'll just virtually come here. But as a result of the tightening of the polls, he has said he's going to be here. Kamala Harris did a virtual town hall meeting here recently. This is a state that shows, again, all the characteristics of places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. That's going to be heavily visited, at least for the next few weeks.
Let me go back to George Floyd for a second. You said that the president has adeptly used that issue. Some people would say cynically used the issue, but let me ask you about, I hate to turn George Floyd's death into a political question, but how does, or does his killing affect the race?
Well, I think, without wanting to talk about the exploitation of George Floyd, because clearly what happened to him, you know, was a tragedy by most accounts here. I think had it just been the peaceful demonstrations, I don't think it would have produced the backlash that it would have. But what happened is when three nights or so after his death, and we had the major rioting in Minneapolis that led to significant fires and destruction. And St. Paul, Minnesota, we had damage also. And if you travel to greater Minnesota, and even though people are a couple hundred miles away, perhaps, from Minneapolis and St. Paul, and you talk to people in greater Minnesota, they're concerned about that violence escalating there. And in the critical suburbs, in Minnesota, it's going to be true as it is nationwide. The suburbs are going to drive the entire election here. You hear people who are saying that, yeah, what happened to Floyd was wrong, the peaceful demonstrations are okay, but the antsiness about the violence, the fires, the rioting and so forth, that's the part that may be backlashing on Democrats. Now, I know nationwide, there's some polling that is suggesting that Trump's not successful or as successful as some people think in terms of exploiting the law and order issue. But I definitely think in Minnesota, in greater Minnesota, the strong Republican base, and perhaps in some of the suburbs, there are people who are concerned about the rioting and looting, and that may be working to Trump's advantage.
Far more than the systemic racism that prompted the rioting to begin with, so just the anger and saying enough is enough, but apparently that is getting lost in this conversation.
It is, and I think also another thing that was a mistake is that when the nine city council members in Minneapolis came out and said defund the police, that I think has not resonated well either in Minneapolis, where polls are suggesting that over a majority oppose it, but statewide, that defund the police movement, is not enjoying support. That's mirrors what we're seeing nationwide. So in many ways, Minneapolis becomes the microcosm for running statewide presidential politics in Minnesota. And as we know, the president is using Minneapolis is sort of the centerpiece of his national presidential campaign.
You know, I know every time I see Trump give a speech in Minnesota, he seems a bit obsessed with winning the state, having come so close last time. And I remember President Reagan holding, I think it was the last day of the campaign in 1984, he held a last-minute press conference in Minnesota in the hope of basically carrying all states. You know, they were talking about, they were accusing him of trying to run up the score. But, I mean, he really wanted to win Minnesota because it would have been a 50-state sweep. I think for the same reason that Reagan wanted Minnesota in 84, I think Trump wants it as well, not because the race nationwide is close, but it just seemed like it was in his grasp 4 years ago, and he just doesn't want to lose it this time.
I think that's clearly part of the answer, but I also think that given the fact that the state of Minnesota, again, has been so reliably in the Democratic camp, if Democrats were to lose Minnesota, that makes it significantly harder for Democrats to win the presidency, because this has been a guaranteed 10 electoral votes. And in an election to where, you know, where I call it right now, there are 43 states. We know what's going to happen. You know, we're pretty sure what New York, California, you know, what's going to happen. We're down to about seven states, including the state of Minnesota. You know, it's 111 electoral votes. Push these 10 out of the Democratic column. Where are the Democrats going to pick up? They're going to have to try to substitute and guarantee a what? They're going to have to win a Florida. They're going to have to win maybe an Arizona, a North Carolina. These are all tough states to win.
David Schultz is a political science professor at Hamline University in St. Paul and author of the book Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter. David, it was great having you on the show.
My pleasure, and have me anytime.
That's something strange.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, who was the last incumbent vice president who wanted his party's presidential nomination but failed to get it? The answer, Alvin Barkley. Barkley, Harry Truman's vice president, wanted to succeed his boss when he unexpectedly announced his retirement in 1952, but Barkley lost at the convention to a dark horse candidate, Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson. And the randomly selected winner is Michael Kane of Media, Pennsylvania. Michael wins the coveted political junkie button. Don't forget, you can always find our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Oh, the sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the old folks are gay. Well, the corn tops right, and the meadows in the bloom, while the birds make music all the day.
With nearly all the primaries having come and gone, we still have Louisiana and a Georgia race in November, the battle for the Senate is basically set. 35 seats are up, with Republicans holding 23 and Democrats 12. There are clearly more vulnerable Republicans than Democrats on the ballot, but is there enough to give the Democrats the majority? That's why we have Jessica Taylor back on the Political Junkie. She's the Senate expert and analyst at the Cook Political Report. Jessica, it's great having you back on the show with just under 2 months to go.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, it's rapidly approaching.
Can't happen. It can't come soon enough for some of us.
Well, in fact, people are voting now.
That's right.
You know, ballots have gone out in North Carolina, so the election is now underway.
That's right. It's not November 3rd. It's every day until November 3rd is November 3rd, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Before we get into the actual candidates, the individual races, what would your headline be right now? Are the Democrats favored to win control? Do they have a strong shot? Is it 50-50? How do you see it right now?
Right now, I see Democrats as a slight favorite, and I think that's because of just the sheer size of the map. And that's for Democrats. They have been able to bring races onto the board that we would not have thought would be even remotely competitive at the beginning of the cycle. Montana, Steve Bullock deciding to run there. That's a race that would not have been competitive at all had they not convinced him at the very last minute to run after his sort of ill-fated campaign for president. South Carolina now on the map with Jamie Harrison raising just over $10 million in August alone.
Against the Republican incumbent, Lindsey Graham.
Right, right. And, you know, Alaska, I think, is one that we still rated as likely Republican, but one that could be coming on the board as well there. They have Al Gross, a doctor and fisherman who's running, who won the Democratic primary, but running as an independent because of sort of a loophole in Alaska's election law. He's sort of trying to challenge Dan Sullivan there.
Let me start with the Democrats because I think it's easier. I mean, Doug Jones of Alabama, I mean, that seems to be it. The only Democratic seat worth really focusing on. He's facing former Auburn football coach Tommy Tuberville. Is Jones finished?
I think he's about close to it. I think that when you had his 2017 special election win there over Roy Moore, everything had to go right, and he still just very narrowly won. Tuberville is very undefined, but he's a football coach, which is as close to a god as you can get in Alabama. And I swear, if even Alabama football fans were going to vote for him in the primary, that they're going to vote for him again, you know, even though he was Auburn and beat them pretty handily. Smokey, stop.
You know, sometimes I read about Gary Peters in Michigan, maybe Gene Shaheen in New Hampshire. Are they in any trouble, or can they be in any trouble?
I don't think Shaheen is really. I think Peters is worth keeping an eye on there in Michigan because you do have John James there, has outraised Peters. He is a pretty strong candidate there, but I think just the statewide numbers that we have seen in Michigan, you know, Trump continues to underperform there, especially compared to 2016. I think Biden will do better there, certainly, than Hillary did, and they're paying more attention to that state. So we still rate it as lean Democratic, but I think you still have to at least keep an eye on Michigan, certainly.
Earlier in the show, we had somebody who talked about that Tina Smith, the race for Tina Smith in Minnesota may be tightening. Is that really happening too?
I want to see a little further out post Labor Day and from the convention. You know, we are not getting a lot of high quality polling out of there right now, at least. You know, if some of these protests and Trump's law and order message works in some of these Midwest states, especially in a place like Minnesota, it's worth watching, certainly.
No matter who, I mean, the primary is long gone, you know, long come and gone. And we knew from the beginning that no matter who was going to win in Massachusetts between Ed Markey and Joe Kennedy, we know that's a, well, yeah, but still. I that sounds like Joe Kennedy supporters in the background barking, but I mean, when just one thing about that, the Markey victory and the signs of the victory still surprise me because when the race started, Kennedy had a huge lead.
He did, and I think that if this had been a traditional race where Kennedy could go out, shake hands, he's a very engaging campaigner. He's very good on the trail. I mean, he's a Kennedy. He exudes personality and charisma, certainly. But when they were forced into this sort of virtual race, I think that Markey supporters are very fervent online. It's this sort of Netroots crowd and progressive, and they sort of made him sort of to be the younger progressive hero.
At 74 years old.
Exactly. You know, he had co-sponsored the Green Deal with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think that if it were sort of the race that Kennedy had planned to run, where he could kind of outwork Ed Markey, who, you know, was absent from the state a lot, spent most of his time, you know, here in the D.C. suburbs, I think it would have been a very different race. But when the race moved to a more virtual format, that's one that favored Markey more.
Does the fact that we've gone away from personal campaigning and more virtual campaigning, does that help incumbents in both parties?
I don't think so this time around because you have a lot of Republican incumbents that are still not very well defined, like Tom Tillis and
in North Carolina.
And Tom Tillis in North Carolina, you know, especially, I think he's the one I think of the most. Perhaps Dan Sullivan in Alaska, or
Martha McSally.
Because she was appointed the first time, so
right.
I think that makes her. You know, she was never elected. In fact, she lost the race in 2018. This is largely, with the exception of Susan Collins and Lindsey Graham, this is the class of 2014 that won election, some in upset races, in a very good Republican year when they last took back the Senate. And conditions are very different now. And so they have not become as well known in their state. That's, I think, a detriment that they face. And I think just with the coronavirus pandemic and how it has played out, you're seeing just a lot of backlash toward Washington in general and then toward Republicans as well.
We know, looking at the map, Democrats need a net gain of 3 to win Senate control and 4 if Trump gets reelected. Who would you say right now are your 4 most vulnerable Republicans?
I think the 4 that stand above, and this has sort of been the top tier that we've had for a while, I rate them as Martha McSally in Arizona, who was, again, appointed to the seat, was not elected. Cory Gardner, then, in Colorado, who is a very good candidate, but is running in what is increasingly a difficult state for Republicans. Tom Tillis in North Carolina, I think, is next. And then that 4th one, I think, has to be Susan Collins. That is sort of the top tier in a way. Although Republicans, again, she is a more seasoned campaigner. She has regularly outrun her party's nominee. But this is really the first really difficult challenge she has faced since she first came to Congress.
I agree with you. That's my 4 as well. For the record, let's just point out, against Susan Collins is Sarah Gideon. Cory Gardner is being challenged by John Hickenlooper in Colorado. Martha McSally, challenged by Mark Kelly in Arizona, and Tom Tillis is being challenged by Cal Cunningham in North Carolina. I agree with you. That's my top 4. There are others to look at. You mentioned Montana, the battle of the two Steves, Steve Bullock and Steve Daines. That's probably as close to a toss-up as I would imagine. But there are other close races to look at, especially... yes.
Oh, baby.
That's not Barbara Boxer.
Yeah, that's smoky.
I saw Barbara Boxer. Okay, I did. But I'm saying, like, Joni Ernst in Iowa, that race seemed to come out of nowhere. She's being opposed by Teresa Greenfield. What's going on there?
It did kind of sneak up, and we've seen a tightening at the presidential level as well. Remember in 2018, Democrats flipped 2 House seats there, came very close in a 4th with Steve King, although now that he has been defeated in a primary, I think that 4th district, which is the most conservative, is safe now. The Republicans won the governor's race with Kim Reynolds there in 2018, so it was kind of a mixed bag. And Ernst has had some missteps. I think she's someone that, you know, she kind of was seen as a rising star there in 2014. You know, everyone remembers her Make Them Squeal ad, but I'm not sure that she was super well-defined beyond that. I think that some of the, trade issues and wars that have popped up have hurt agriculture there in the state too. She was recently at an event where she appeared to latch on to a QAnon theory that the death rate, the death toll of coronavirus has been vastly overinflated. And so that's something that Democrats are already hitting her on, that Greenfield's campaign is. I think this is a very, very close race, and it's one that Republicans have increasingly become worried about in the past few weeks.
2 Republicans that many Democrats would love to see defeated, of course, are Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell. What are your thoughts on those 2 races? Those are big Republican states.
They are. I rate Kentucky as the likely Republican that's going to see a lot of money. I'm not sure that it's going to move the needle a lot. South Carolina, I recently moved into the lean Republican category. Jamie Harrison is running a really strong race there. And there's the South Carolina 1st District that also is going to be very competitive, with Joe Cunningham driving a lot. And that's where Harrison needs to do really well. And, you know, he has a very inspiring story running. He was a former state party chairman, the first African-American state party chairman, and really rose from poverty and Orangeburg, which is sort of the center of the corridor of shame, and really harsh educational conditions in South Carolina, and ended up going to Ivy League schools then. And he's, I think if he can turn out black voters, especially there in the state, and that can be aided by Biden too, certainly. You know, that's the state that turned around his presidential hopes in the primary. I still think that getting those last few points for a Democrat is still really hard in a state that is still very fundamentally Republican. But we are seeing some suburban shifts, not just around Charleston, but around Greenville, the sort of Charlotte exurbs that go into York County and Rock Hill in South Carolina, too. But I'm still not sure it's enough. But I think it is one worth watching because the sheer amount of money being spent there as well. So I think South Carolina is more competitive than Kentucky at this point and more worth watching.
Not too long ago, people were saying that President Trump was a drag on his party's Senate candidates. Do you think that's still the case?
You have a lot of incumbents that have been forced to choose sides. If Cory Gardner has sort of been able to sort of stay along his own path, if Susan Collins had, I think they would be much better off, but they worried about primary challenges and really need the base, too, that is still very loyal to Trump. So I think that in that regard, he can. Whether, you know, the race maybe continues to tighten across the board, we're not seeing that on the national level as much, 1 or 2 points, but that could still be within the margin of error. Listen, we're in crunch time now, post-Labor Day, and I think we're going to be seeing more regular polling, hopefully higher quality polling coming out, and, you know, live caller now looks likely voter screens, we hope.
The two obvious final questions, can the Democrats win control of the Senate, and will they?
Can they? Yes. Will they? We will see. The path is there.
Will we? We will see. Oh, no.
I mean, I can't say for certain. I think that they're a slight favorite right now, as we see it, and I would rather be Democrats at this point than Republicans, but I think the next polls coming out the next few weeks will give us a better idea of whether, you know, the conventions really move things, whether some of these things are tightening in the Midwest, maybe some Arizona voters start coming home in the Sun Belt. But yeah, I think the Sun Belt remains a major problem for Trump there in places like Georgia, Arizona, maybe even South Carolina. But again, there are multiple paths at this point for Democrats, too.
Jessica Taylor is the Senate analyst at the Cook Political Report. Jessica, thank you for being on the program, and I appreciate you taking your time on while you're on the road with that fierce, barking dog in the background.
Smokey likes to make appearances. He's a media hog.
Thanks, Jessica.
Here come the rich man in his big, long limousine. Here come the poor man. Now you got the heavy screen. Here come the banker and the lawyer and the cop. One thing for certain, too heavy. That's when they come and they go. They go. With only one thing in common, they got the fire down below.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. An important note about The Political Junkie. Our format will be changing after this week. We'll be moving away from producing an hour-long show that's also heard on radio stations, and focusing entirely on the weekly podcast. Please know that because of this switch, the show can only survive with your contributions. Please check our messages on Facebook and Twitter to learn more. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our coordinating producer and editor is Douglas Bell. Thank you, PRX, for distributing our program these past 7 years. And Douglas Bell, I shudder to think where The Political Junkie would be without you. Anyway, I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks, as always, for listening. This show has always been about you, the listener. Hope to see you soon.